All right, so let's turn to the book of Lamentations. I've already given you some introductory material to this. And, you know, if you're like me, you are unfamiliar with this book. I mean, who here thinks they really know the book of Lamentations? No one raised their hand. It's just a book we're not familiar with. How many sermons have you heard based on it? How many times have you heard it quoted in sermons or classes or articles you've read or books or whatever? We do have some songs, I pointed that out last week or the week before, that are based on the book of Lamentations or passages from Lamentations. But as far as this book here, just being familiar with it, I mean, I've been preaching and teaching for 39 years. So I read through the Bible every year, and so I come across Lamentations over and over again. But to look at it like how we're going to, I confess I'm just not as familiar with it as I should be. So it's going to be something that we're going to be doing here together. And what I want to do, if you remember, I showed you how all five chapters are five different poems. So I want to read the first poem, just the whole thing. You know, often, you know, we'll read a section, then we talk about it in a section, read about it. But since we're unfamiliar with this, I just want to read this whole poem. Probably wouldn't hurt to read the whole book in just in one sitting. But anyways, we'll just do chapter one, and then we'll come back and talk about it. Okay, so here's Lamentations chapter one. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she, who was great among the nations. The princess among the provinces has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into captivity. Under affliction and hard servitude, she dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in dire straits. The roads to Zion mourn because no one comes to the set feasts. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness. Her adversaries have become the master. Her enemies prosper, for the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the daughter of Zion, all her splendor has departed. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture, that flee without strength before the pursuer. In the days of her affliction and roaming, Jerusalem remembers all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old. When her people fell into the hand of the enemy with no one to help her, the adversaries saw her and mocked at her downfall. Jerusalem has sinned gravely, therefore she has become vile. All who honored her despise her because they have seen her nakedness. Yes, she sighs and turns away. Her uncleanness is in her skirts. She did not consider her destiny. Therefore, her collapse was awesome. She had no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy is exalted. The adversary has spread his hand over all her pleasant things. For she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you commanded not to enter her assembly. All her people sigh. They seek bread. They have given their valuables for food to restore life. See, O Lord, and consider, for I am scorned. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Behold and flee. If there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which has been brought on me, which the Lord has inflicted in the day of his fierce anger, from above he has sent fire into my bones, and it overpowered them. He has spread a net for my feet and turned me back. He has made me desolate and faint all the day. The yoke of my transgressions was bound. They were woven together by his hands and thrust upon my neck. He made my strength fail. The Lord delivered me into the hands of those whom I am not able to withstand. The Lord has trampled underfoot all my mighty men in my midst. He has called an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord trampled as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. For these things I weep. My eye overflows with water, because the Comforter, who should restore my life, is far from me. My children are desolate because the enemy prevailed. Zion spreads out her hands, but no one comforts her. The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that those around him become his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. The Lord is righteous, for I rebelled against his commandment. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my sorrow. My virgins and my young men have gone into captivity. I called for my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and my elders breathed their last in the city while they sought food to restore their life. See, O Lord, that I am in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned within me. For I have been very rebellious. Outside, the sword bereaves. At home, it is like death. They have heard that I sigh, but no one comforts me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you have done it. Bring on the day you have announced, that they may become like me. Let all their wickedness come before you, and do to them as you have done to me. For all my transgressions, for my sighs are many, and my heart is faint. Okay, did you notice, as I went through that the voice changed? In verses 1 through 11, it's Jeremiah speaking. Then starting at verse 12 through 22, it's Jerusalem speaking. Now granted, it's Jeremiah, I understand that. But he's speaking to the first person in the first 11 verses, and then he switches over to Jerusalem speaking in the last half of this poem. And he's expressing, I'm sure, what he sees the other people thinking, what they're feeling, maybe what they're saying. And so now he gives his thoughts, then he gives the thoughts of Jerusalem to God. And to me, it's very moving. What did you think of that chapter as I read it? What impressed you, Nancy?
They were just devastated.
Yeah, they experienced a devastation that I've never experienced before. I would guess that none of us ever have.
They lost everybody.
Yeah.
They lost their leaders, their elders.
One of the things that I picture in my mind, excuse me, is Europe at the end of World War II. You've seen either pictures or video and just what it looks like or looked like. Buildings knocked down, and hardly any people because they're mostly dead. What a sad, sad sight, you know. And that's what I mean. Jeremiah here, he's just pouring his heart out, is he not? What I think is interesting is that initially Jeremiah did not reveal the problems of Israel, or more specifically, of Jerusalem. He simply viewed a once great city and then look at it now. He speaks to God. He speaks to their enemies. He speaks to almost anyone, his fellow Jews, whoever it was. You know, look. Look what we've experienced. He mourned deeply. And, you know, it's good to mourn. There's a time to mourn, kind of like in the spirit of Solomon. I don't know if you've noticed that in Ecclesiastes 3. He says there's a time to laugh, a time to mourn, there's a time to live, a time to die, and all that kind of stuff. And here, it was a time to mourn. And Jeremiah is not embarrassed to show his mourning. I think as Americans, we have a tendency, and maybe even some European nations, we have a tendency to hide our emotions. Especially when we're just breaking down, like how Jeremiah was here, because we think it's a bad thing. Have you ever noticed how, let's say a woman's husband has died, and she can't be comforted. She's crying, she's mourning, she won't stop. It just goes on and on. And people will ask, how is she doing? And what will they say? Okay. What was that, Gloria?
She's doing fine. She'll say.
Well, but, okay, right. But what will others say about her? Like, usually we'll say she's not doing very good. And I've always thought, well, why is that not a good thing? If you've, if you're deeply in love with someone, like Jeremiah was deeply in love with Jerusalem and his people, and all of a sudden they're dead, they're destroyed, what is wrong with just pouring out the emotion, just opening up? And I think maybe the eastern part of the world, what we might call the East, they're probably a lot stronger about that than we are. I'm not sure why there's the difference. We have our weaknesses and strengths, and they have their weaknesses and strengths. But in my opinion, who's writing this, a man or a woman? A man. And for some reason, again, we say men are not emotional and women are. And I disagree with that. I think we show our emotions differently, but men are just as emotional as women. And I wouldn't call Jeremiah effeminate. I think he was a man, just as much as any other man. And this man he's just broken up. He's been preaching to these people for how many years, and they wouldn't listen to him. They could have avoided all this. And now he sees the huge power of Babylon come in, surround his city, knock down the walls, kill the people, destroy the temple, take all its treasures, take some survivors back to Babylon, and leave very few people in the land. Why shouldn't this man cry without embarrassment? I can still remember at the end of the first Persian Gulf War when General Norman Schwarzkopf, who, if you're speaking according to the world, was definitely a man's man, and he lived in Florida, and when his plane landed, you know, he's done over there, and he came out the plane, and he just stood there in the doorway. And if I remember right, he may have been saluting the national anthem, may have been playing or something, but his bottom lip was just quivering. Because he was a very emotional man. You know, and I wouldn't say, hey, suck it up, General. You know, men don't cry. Well, why not? You follow what I'm saying? Nancy, you started to say something.
Well, he's lamenting all these things that happened, but in 18 and 20, he's putting the problem where it lies, for I rebelled
right
against his commandment.
Yeah.
He mentions that.
Yeah, he eventually does get to that. But at first, all he's just looking at is, look what's happened. But then he does say, you know, it's especially when he speaks on behalf of Jerusalem, like in verse 18 that you mentioned, the Lord is righteous, for I rebelled against his commandment. You know, the Lord said this was going to happen. He said, this is the way you're supposed to live it. Don't live this way. If you live the way I tell you to, here's how you'll be blessed. If you don't live the way I tell you to live, here's the consequences. Okay, now notice in verses 1 and 2, the reversals. Okay? just look at how things have been reversed. The city was once full of people. Now he said it was what? It was what?
Like a widow.
Okay, or even before that,
lonely.
It was lonely. Generally, we like smaller towns as Americans. And we don't want all the traffic, But imagine our city, Grants Pass here, having been, you know what our traffic is like. And you know the people downtown and people all over the place, people here. But now imagine that a foreign power has come in and attacked us. And what is our population here? What can I think of what it is?
34.
I was going to say in the 30s someplace. But now there's only 300 people left in the city. There's dead bodies all over the place. All the businesses are they're knocked down, the buildings. You know, everything's on fire. Would you... Now, there's fewer people. Would you prefer that, or would you prefer the city back to being prosperous when there's a lot of people there and the traffic's bad and everything? I'd say, give me that. You know, and that's what Jeremiah was looking at here. This place was full of people. It was the religious center of Israel. The temple was there. So many good things. And now, it's lonely. What is it like to be a widow? And we've got a couple of widows in here. I can try and guess what it's like, but do any of you widows want to speak up and say, what is it like to be a widow? He mentions loneliness there as being a big thing. What is the loneliness like?
It's probably like half of you is gone.
Like part of you is gone? Notice how, okay, Jeremiah contrasts the widowhood with something else. She's like a widow, but she was what before?
She was great among the
nations. Great among the nations. And why? Let me say this. How great was Jerusalem among the nations? Could anybody just go ahead and conquer Israel, Judah, or Jerusalem if they wanted to?
I don't think so.
No. As long as they were faithful to God, it didn't matter how strong the power was. They could be held off. Or if God wanted his people to attack, they could do it. It didn't matter how strong, innovative, or powerful the enemy was. They could take care of them. And why was that? When you look at all what would have been all the countries of the world then and all the cities, what did Jerusalem have that none of those other cities had?
God.
The what?
God.
Okay, they had God. And what was there, physically speaking?
The temple.
What was that, Gene?
The temple.
Did you say temple?
The temple.
Okay, Solomon's temple was there. And that, you know, what was the temple? That was the place where, you know, sacrifices were made, as you know. The high priest would go into the second room, the Holy of Holies, and meet with God there. God actually met with a human in that room. I mean, I think that made Jerusalem stand out more than any other city. I don't care how more beautiful another city was or how much more prosperous or whatever. Jerusalem was the place where God met the high priest on top of the Ark of the Covenant between the cherubim, known as the mercy seat. Remember that? And I think I pointed out to you that the book of Ezekiel, which is talking about the same time, shows the glory of God slowly leaving the temple. If I remember right, the glory of God's there on top of the Ark of the Covenant, and then it moves to the curtain area, the doorway between the Holy of Holies and the holy place. And then he moves out to the threshold. And then he moves out, I think it was to maybe the gate into the city or something, or the gate into the courtyard or whatever. It's like he didn't want to leave. But the people had these idols and other abominable things right there in the temple, he had to leave. Okay, so also notice here that Jeremiah talks about the princess becoming a slave. That's not the way it's supposed to be, is it? And you can just, I think verse 2 just shows his own personal utter sadness. He's talking about Jerusalem weeping bitterly in the night, tears on the cheeks because they're just flowing down. No one's coming to comfort her, although she had lovers before, the idols and the foreign powers that introduced those idols to Israel, or vice versa, whichever way it was. You know, and they're all just dealing bad with her, and he's mourning them. Okay, so verses 1 through 3, he talks about how the city is deserted. You know, Judah should have been on top of the world, but according to verse 3, what happened? She's gone into captivity under affliction and hard servitude. And why did the roads to Zion or Jerusalem mourn? And why were they going to Zion? What does he say here? Yeah, exactly. Because no one comes to the set feast. So, I mean, you know how it is with any city today, not just Jerusalem, but with any city, you know, like Grants Pass. Of course, we have I-5 that runs by it. You've got highways that go out to the coast. You know, there's ways in and out of our city all over the place, and you know, there's business that needs to take place. People are going on vacation. You know how that is. But with Jerusalem in particular, he's not just talking about business or people going on vacation. But why did Jerusalem exist? It existed because that's where God wanted to set up earthly worship, and where those sacrifices were made, and where he would have his kings and his priests and his prophets and everything. And so, as you probably know, the males, at least, had to go to Jerusalem, what was it, 3 times a year for 3 different feasts in particular. They had more feasts than that, of course, but he wanted them, or was it once a year? I can't remember exactly right now. But you can imagine when those feast times came, well, kind of like here. What's the traffic like on 6th and 7th Street today? But tomorrow, you know, at... Well, I try, when I come here to my office, I try and leave at 4:30. Because if I don't, and I hit downtown at 5 o'clock, it's like, I should just park and drive or walk the rest of the way. I should have another car at the other end of town. That's what I should do. And then when I come in the next morning, park it, walk to the next car, and come back up here. And that, anyway, I'm sure it got that way with Zion. During those feasts, all of a sudden there would be people coming from all over Israel just converging on this town and just filling it with people, and it was a good time. If you remember when Jesus was 12 and he and his parents went to Jerusalem, do you remember that something happened when they left? When Joseph and Mary left, was Jesus with them?
No.
Well, do you remember what the Bible says they were thinking?
Well, he was with the rest of the family.
Yeah. It was a huge crowd that would be going north. Of course, they're going to go to Nazareth. There's a huge, who knows, probably thousands of people. And at 12 years old, he probably seemed like a mature kid. Kind of sounds funny to refer to Jesus as a kid, doesn't it? But he was a mature kid. He never gotten in trouble. So they just thought, he's okay. He's with the rest of the family someplace. My point being, there were so many people that they didn't know where he was. And of course, they eventually can't find him, you know, and you know the rest of that story there. Okay, verses 5 through 6. The splendor has departed. And here, for the first time in this poem, Jeremiah revealed Zion's problem. What did Jeremiah name in a general way?
The multitude of her transgressions.
That's right. Yeah, he doesn't mention what the transgression is yet, just that she had transgressions and a multitude of them. So it wasn't just for a one-time sin that this is happening. But the city had filled the city. The people of the city had filled it with transgression. And what were the signs that Zion's splendor had departed? Verse 6.
Princes had become like deer.
Yeah, okay, that's really just one sign. The princes had become like deer. They couldn't find any pasture, so they fled without strength before the pursuer. Someone's pursuing them instead of them doing the pursuing. It was to Jeremiah, that was a very sad thing. All right, 7 through 10. Here they are. The pleasant things that they had enjoyed were only a memory. So when things got bad, what did Jerusalem remember? Verse 7.
All the precious things.
Yeah, all those precious things, those pleasant things of old, she now started thinking back on those things. And what problem did Jeremiah reveal in verse 8?
He talks about her sin again.
Okay, and this time he describes it how?
Gravely
in the New King James. Yeah, here in the New King James, he has Jerusalem has sinned gravely. Does anybody else in their different translations have a different wording? What was that, Glorian?
Grievously.
Okay. All sin is bad, isn't it? But not all sin's the same. I know most people don't agree with that, but remember Jesus when he was before Pilate? And Jesus said, "He who delivered you to me, or delivered me to you, has greater sin." That's in John 18. Pilate was guilty of getting ready to kill an innocent man. But the priests and the Jewish leaders and so on, they were guilty of turning over the Son of God. And they should have known that he was the Son of God. Pilate should have known he was an innocent man. In fact, he even confessed that. I don't see what he's done wrong. But he had him killed anyways. The Jews had the prophecies, they saw his miracles, they heard his teachings. They should have known that he was the Messiah. So they had him killed. Their sin was greater. And so when you have a multitude of sins, like we've already noticed that Jerusalem has pointed out, they've been sinning gravely. They've just given themselves over to it completely. Look at, there's something that Solomon said one time in Ecclesiastes that always puzzled me. I want to say it's Ecclesiastes 5. Let me see here. No, it's Ecclesiastes 7. Ecclesiastes 7, 16 and 17. He says this. Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? Now, isn't that interesting? What would you think? Okay, and this book is called Ecclesiastes, which that word means preacher. So what would you think if Solomon was our speaker this morning, and he stood here and said, "Brethren, don't be overly righteous, and don't be overly wise. And in fact, don't be overly wicked, nor foolish." I mean, that would get my attention. I'm like, what? Don't I want to be as righteous as possible? Don't I want to be as wise as possible? And, of course, a lot of times we want to infer something that the writer or speaker never implied. But we have a tendency to read something like verse 17 where he says, "Do not be overly wicked," as though he's saying it's okay to be a little wicked. So what would he mean by that? Maybe I should let you think about that for a week and then we can talk about this. I think what is going on there is, you know, okay, we all sin. But be careful. Don't let yourself get carried away with it. For if you do, you'll get so entangled in it, you'll never come out of it, and you'll destroy yourself. You'll die before your time. So he's not saying it's okay to sin a little bit, be a little wicked, but just, you know, make sure that you don't get entangled in it, or you'll be sorry, is the idea. And so I come back here to Lamentations and what Jeremiah has said. And again, Jerusalem's sins had just piled up to the point where, remember when we were studying Jeremiah, I showed you 2 Chronicles 36, where Ezra, the writer, said that Jerusalem had gone beyond remedy. There was nothing that could bring her back. That's why God sent Babylon. Okay, so where am I in all that talking? That was verse 8, wasn't it? Okay, so verse 9. What did she fail to do according to verse 9?
She never considered where she was going.
Yeah. It's like she did not consider her destiny.
No, she became so enmeshed in that sin that she could not turn around and go the other way.
Yeah, and that's again revealing the problem there. If you can get so entangled in sin that you're not thinking about where it's going to lead you. You know, and it can happen with particular sins, like anger. You can just let your anger go and you don't realize where it's going, and suddenly you're in deep trouble. So she wasn't thinking about where is all this idolatry? That was her primary sin. Where is this idolatry going to lead us? And since these idols hadn't helped the other nations, why would they help Israel? They weren't thinking that. According to verse 10, who was not supposed to enter the sanctuary?
Other nations. The nations.
And in particular here, we're talking about Babylon. Babylon wasn't authorized to be in the temple at all. In a sense, they were authorized because God sent them there. I understand that. But according to the law of Moses, could any Israelite go into the temple? No. Who only could go in there, especially into the Holy of Holies?
The tribe of Levi, the high priest.
And the high priest had to be descended from a particular Levite.
Yeah.
Beverly? Aaron, that's right. So, if God was that specific even among the Israelites, he definitely didn't want the nations in there. They just were not qualified. But they went in there anyways. I mean, as you know, Denise and I and a couple others were there in Jerusalem this past July, and we didn't see the temple there, did we? Instead, it's the Dome of the Rock in the very place where the temple used to be. Okay, verse 11. Here Jerusalem went from possessing valuable things to begging. All her people sigh, they seek bread. They have given their valuables for food. Okay, maybe you have your mother's diamond ring or something, her engagement ring. Or you have something from your dad that you inherited. I mean, something that's, you can't put a price on it, but now you're selling it, even though it's worth thousands, maybe even tens of thousands, and now you're selling it just so you can have lunch today. Can you imagine doing that? But that's what they did. All right, so then the next half of this poem, I guess it's a psalm too, verses 12 through 22. Look at 12 through 15, where he talks about Jerusalem's suffering. In verse 12, Jerusalem noted that others did not seem to care or understand the plight of Jerusalem. And that hurts. Doesn't it? Have you been hurting before? Something's been wrong in your life and people didn't seem to care? Or have you ever gone to the doctor and for some reason the doctor, I don't know, was having a bad day, or the nurses or something, and they didn't really seem to care? That can be pretty distressing, especially when you're going to someone who's supposed to be helping you. Verse 13, although the destruction came from Babylon, How did Jerusalem see the destruction? Is Jerusalem talking about the Babylonians in verse 13 or someone else? God. That's exactly right. Yeah, Babylon or Jerusalem recognized, yeah, it was the Babylonians that did it, but God was behind it. What also caught my attention, that first line in verse 13, New King James Version here, from above he has sent fire into my bones. That's not the first time we've had that terminology from Jeremiah. Look back at Jeremiah 20 and verse 9. And this is when Jeremiah's ministry was not going so well, and people are persecuting him. They won't listen to what he has to say. And so he said in 20, verse 9, "Then I said, I will not make mention of him, nor speak any more in his name. But his word was in my heart like a burning fire shut up in my bones. I was weary of holding it back, and I could not." And so he starts speaking again. I think it's kind of interesting that here he's talking about a different kind of a fire that's in his bones, or in the bones of Jerusalem, here in Lamentations 1:13. But it has the same effect. There's a fire in my bones. I have to speak. Describe the yoke of Jerusalem's transgressions. Verse 14. Picture for me what he's picturing for us. The yoke of my transgressions was bound. They were woven together by his hands and thrust upon my neck. The way I literally picture that is all my sins, and God just binds them all in a big bundle, and then he hangs it on my neck. What a burden that would be. And you can't bear up under it. You're going to fall. And that's exactly what happened to Jerusalem. He took all their sins and just bound them up and hung them on her neck until she fell. What had the Lord done to Jerusalem in verse 15? What was that? Rejected? And what's the literal picture you see going on there?
He trampled as in a wine press.
Yeah, now see the God of heaven that we always talk about being full of love and grace and mercy, and he is all those things. And he had been that way for Jerusalem for a long time. But now, he's standing up, and here's his mighty men, and he's stomping all over them. Not a pretty picture at all. That's pretty brutal, in fact. Okay, in verses 16 and 17, he talks about Jerusalem being without comforters. Jerusalem just had no comfort. And here he's picturing Jerusalem's overwhelming loneliness there in 16 and 17. For these things I weep. His eye overflows. He even says, my eye, he repeats it. Because I think he's in deep agony here. My eye overflows with tears. You've had that, all of us have that experience, I'm sure, sometime or another, where you just have so many tears you can't even see. Because your eyes are just flooded with tears, and then they start running down your cheeks. It's overflowing. And was Jerusalem or Zion in verse 17 looking for comfort? Yeah, so she's spreading out her hands, but like, help me. No one's doing it. 18 through 20. Jerusalem's troubles come. come from disobedience. And this is where Jerusalem is making that confession, okay? What did Jerusalem confess in verse 18? We kind of looked at it earlier. It's a twofold confession. First about the Lord, and then about itself, herself.
They rebelled against His commandments.
What was that, Diane?
They rebelled against His commandments.
And what did Jerusalem say before that? What did they confess?
The Lord is righteous.
The Lord's righteous. On His part, He's been righteous. On my part, I've been rebellious. What had, according to verse 19, what had Jerusalem's lovers done?
Deceived them.
What was that, Diane?
Deceived them.
Okay, because evidently, like the idols. I think he's referring to the idols. The idols, and it's not so much the idols themselves, but the idolaters proclaim, this God, whatever it was, Baal, the Ashtoreth, or whatever, promises this for you. But it didn't come to pass. And the city could see that now. But Jeremiah had been saying it, Isaiah had been saying it, both books that we've already studied recently. Isaiah, I think Jeremiah did too, I can't remember right now, but at least Isaiah, I mean, he made fun of idolatry. A man cuts down a tree, and he builds things with it, he uses some wood to cook a fire, and with the leftovers, he makes an idol and says, "You're my God, deliver me." I mean, that's hilarious when you think about it. But it points out the truth that an idol is zip, it's nada, nothing. What did Jerusalem want the Lord to see? Verse 20.
They were in distress.
Yeah, God, look. See what I'm suffering here. I'm in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned.
As if he didn't know already.
Yeah.
Diane?
As if he didn't realize that.
Right, yeah. But I think, you know, when you're in deep mourning like this, and especially if you're a Christian, or in their case, you know, one of the Jews, God's supposed to be with me through everything. And there's sometimes when it seems like He's silent. You know, yes, Nancy?
He warned them.
Right. But there's sometimes when... you can think about the psalmists. A lot of the psalmists would say, "Why are you hiding, God?" Because sometimes we think that. Where is He? I've been praying about this without end. The Bible says to pray without ceasing. That's exactly what I'm doing, but nothing's happening.
Well,
have you been there before?
They had to get to this point.
Right.
I mean, this is where it all... They just went down so far that God had to do what He had to do to get them to this point. They
right.
They recognize where they are at and why they got.
Right, exactly. Okay, 21 and 22. Now Jerusalem asks for God to repay the enemy. How did Jerusalem's enemies react to Jerusalem's destruction? Right in the middle of verse 21.
They were glad.
That's right. They were glad to see Jerusalem suffer this way. Edom in particular. We saw that from the book of Jeremiah. Edom was really glad, and they were glad that Babylon came in, because now Edom could go in and take things and do things. And they couldn't before because they weren't as strong as Israel. So they were glad that God had done this. So the city is saying, "God, what you've done to me, now do to them." And He did. Remember that again, that's the last part of Jeremiah. Chapters 49 through 51, he said, this is what's going to happen to Babylon. It's because they also had sin. Okay, so it's important to remember that, yes, Jerusalem had sinned, but the enemy was not without sin itself. So, I just want to kind of go back and talk about a couple of things with the few minutes that we have left, about 4 minutes. Can mourning be good for the soul? It can, can't it? Didn't Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, the very beginning of his ministry, say, "Blessed are the mournful, or those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." Or look at Ecclesiastes. Chapter 7 again.
God created us with all the emotions, whether good, bad, joyful, or whatever. So if it's an emotion that He gave us, it will be exercised if we allow it. And therefore, it obviously has to have some good. And I think it's to empty out and get to a point, whether it's mourning for something of your own doing or something of someone else's. Doing, it's an emotion that has been placed there, and therefore use it.
Yeah, okay, so he gave us that capacity.
Yes.
And there's a time to use it. Look at Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 4. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Okay, so the Bible does talk about being joyful and rejoicing and so on, right? Both Old and New Testaments. So we recognize that. But again, in the spirit of Ecclesiastes 3, which Solomon just says a little bit earlier in the book, you know, there's a time, there is a, to everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck what is planted, and so on. And there's, when it's the time to mourn, don't rejoice, mourn. And when it's the time to rejoice, don't mourn. I always thought that was interesting in Nehemiah chapter 8. The people told Ezra and Nehemiah, bring the word of God out to us and read it for us. So they did, and they started they started crying. Because they realized where they had fallen short, and they see that God has been true with His promises, both for blessing and cursing. But the people had repented. So both Ezra and Nehemiah tell the people, don't mourn. Go home and rejoice. Everything's good now. So again, there's that there is a proper time for mourning. Also, eventually, we suffer the consequences of rebellion. Look at Numbers chapter 32. Okay, in Numbers 32, it's towards the end of the life of Moses, and a couple of the tribes came to him and said, you know what, we want to stay on the east side of the Jordan. And man, he got angry. And he lectured them, and he said, you know, don't you remember what happened 40 years ago when we sent the spies into the land, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to settle on the east side, but we'll go in and fight first for our brethren and so forth and so on. And so Moses was okay with that, but he gave them a warning. Let me just give this to you, and then I know the bell rang. He says, but if you do not do so, this is Numbers 32:23, but if you do not do so, then take note, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Numbers 32:23. Okay, so remember that one. Oh, and also the last thing I wanted to make a point was, remember that the Lord says what He means and means what He says. Okay, so chapter 2 next week. And hopefully I'll be 100%.